You know, when you respond correctly to dumbass questions, that's what happens.
Welcome to the GappaCast. We are, as you are well aware, the internet's only South Carolina Gamecocks sports podcast in existence, in the universe, in this actual dimension. At least in South, we really want to investigate. I am DC3. Alongside me, as always, the other two legs of the faithful triumvirate, Sam and Alex. Gentlemen, how art thou?
We're the only podcast to ever podcast anything about the Gamecocks. Ever. It's never happened before. It'll never happen again after we're done.
Also, let it be known that I will never have a career as a Chip or Joanna Canes. It took me 2.5 hours to install a simple ceiling fan. I'm not afraid to admit that.
Why don't we talk about this? Why don't we talk about this? Because
I'm still having some. So it turns out in this house, the way that some of these electrical boxes were put in was very shoddy, so I'm having to like take old boxes out and put new ones in, and it's a nightmare.
So what we're saying is we might need to ramp up your thing that we've been talking about.
Well, the ceiling fan looks great now, so it's working awesome.
Well, if you lived in my wife's world, ceiling fans are the devil and should never be monkeyed with in the first place. So,
yeah, I don't have enough box fans to keep me cool, so ceiling fans are a must.
I'm gonna divert from what I originally had from our intro question for just a moment. Oh, is this a guy thing, or is this just a rational human being thing that people need circulating air? Am I correct?
Absolutely. It's 2019.
Yeah. I mean, yes. This isn't 200 years ago. People need circulating air. It's how we're conditioned to live today. I think it's just science. People way back before AC, they didn't know any better, so they didn't know the difference. Well, we know better because we're better than they were, so we need AC.
Even in places like Maine, where they don't use air conditioners, you know, for the most part because the weather's so nice, they still have fans to circulate the air.
Right. Air just can't be stale. Yeah. That sucks.
I mean, ceiling fans are a creation of God for a reason, right?
Absolutely.
I just want to make sure I'm not crazy.
No. They're heaven sent, for sure.
Speaking of heaven sent.
This has been your local home improvement section from the GabbaCast.
And if you need help with your ceiling fan, don't call me.
Yes, please do.
Well,
not
we'll tell you
Alex.
Who not to call, and it's Alex. Don't call Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything. Also, may we just make sure that everyone is aware of as our extended stature as influential social media members. Any and all information that is given on this podcast, including any or all in opinions, are not necessarily a reflection of the larger parent company, SB Nation, Vox Media, or Garnet Black Attack. Three stupid idiots on the internet talking about nothing in general.
I'm pretty sure most people that work for Garnet Black Attack don't even know we exist, so I'm not really worried about that.
I'm 100% certain that they don't know we exist.
Yeah. So anyway,
Sam,
how are you?
I said, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm just happy to be on the only Gamecock podcast ever. I think you had an intro question you wanted to ask.
From the heavens, or a gift from heaven, Hollywood has decided to gift us, or, well, from that fact, re-gift us with several films that are very, very, very familiar to us on an elemental level from years gone by or from decades gone by, none the least of which most recently include The Lion King and a new Top Gun reboot. I'm not going to go into all of the other rebooted movies that have gone, come and gone in the last two or three years or so. Heretofore, I have my own opinions, but I just wanted to say two questions. One, it makes me think very highly of the original every single time I have ever seen a remake. I don't know if that's just me or if that's something that should be just addressed before anybody ever thinks about remaking a movie ever. The lone exception being some of the Batman reboots. It's the only film franchise that has ever been rebooted that I think may or may not have ever needed to have been revisited. And that does not mean that I do not disagree with the Tim Burton version of Batman films. I'm just going to say that The Dark Knight was good. Period. End of sentence. Batman Begins. Batman Begins was a good movie. Period. End of sentence. That being said, what movie, if there was a movie, I mean, we're going all the way back to anything. Nothing is off the table here. What movie would you most like to see remade? And there's a secondary question. You're flipping through the channels. What movie comes on and there is no chance in hell, doesn't matter if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you were trying to turn the TV off and you accidentally hit the channel up or channel down button, what movie are you going to tune in for no matter what?
So pretty much all remakes suck. Like all remakes of good movies suck. Now, I'm not saying like, now I say pretty much, so not 100%, but I'd say like 98.5% of all remakes or like sequels that are 20 years down the line from the original movie, they pretty much all suck. And I think that's a combination of the movie not being as good as the predecessor and the expectations being way too high for the audience going into the remake, to watch the remake. So I'm going to say none movie yes. should be remade. Hollywood needs to rediscover its creative gene and come up with something original sometime before this current decade is over. The movies that come on TV and I'm watching no matter what is either of the main, or I'm sorry, so Major League One or Major League Two, either one of those. If it's on TV, I'm watching it. Not Alex. Like not Major League 3 and 4 and all the spin-off movies, like the main team.
No.
Just really seeing Major League, that's it.
Right.
I'm kind of the same on this one with the remakes. You know, like you mentioned the Batman movies, and those are a little bit different, I think, because you can take superhero movies and, you know, about every decade or so, like release another one and maybe introduce a new bad guy or, you know, different directors take. And so, like, superhero reboots, I don't have much of a problem with. Now, if they try to take, like, you know, a specific movie itself and then remake that one, then I think there's a problem. But as far as remakes go, they just need to stop, because any movie worth anything, it's never going to be. I mean, like, even if you say, well, technology may be better now, and so you take a 1980s sci-fi movie to try to make it better with better technology, part of the beauty of how awful it was or how great it was in 1980 is because the technology was so bad. And so they have miniature, you know, explosions of spaceships and whatever else. But the two movies for me that, like, if they're on, then I just watch. One is a guilty pleasure for sure. It's Zombieland. I don't know what it is about that movie. Woody Harrelson cracks me up, and that movie is hilarious. It is a gem. But the other one is an old classic called Harvey, where James Stewart plays a delightful man named Elwood P. Dowd, and he has a best friend that is a 10-foot invisible rabbit that no one can see but him. And it's a very good story, and those are the two movies. It doesn't matter if they're – sometimes, even if they're not on, like especially with Harvey, if I can't sleep, I'll just put it in the DVD player. Because I actually still have one of those, so.
As do I, because apparently there is no digital reproduction of the original Cinderella.
Not yet.
Available at current.
Not yet. It's coming though, probably.
It's in the vault.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's gotta be someplace besides the Greenville County Library, but to date I have not been able to find it anywhere other than the damn Greenville County Library. So I'm actually gonna really, really, really tell you guys how dull I am in that the remake that I would most like to see made is actually Casablanca. Only because, now, hear me out. There is no better theatrical couple, so to speak. You cannot recreate the actors I can't ever fix that film. I don't have a replication for Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. I can't do that. I can't fix that. But what I could do is potentially fix some of the campiness of the acting in Casablanca. Maybe that hits home, maybe that doesn't. But, you know, I'm sure as shit not trying to figure out, like, who I can get to replace them, because you're never going to get there. There's a reason why I didn't reference my favorite movie of all time, which is The Americanization of Emily. That's another thing. It's because those films in the 40s and 50s were just so... They were epic stories. They were novels that just so happened to be set to screen. Today, we set to screen, and we just try and kind of figure out, like, it's like designing a housing community. It's like designing a golf course around a housing community instead of designing a housing community around a golf course. We do everything backwards now in filmmaking. And I just want to see what Hollywood could do with a remake of probably the most iconic film, not necessarily a Marx Brothers like classic, but it's something. Anyways, the film that I would like to watch no matter what, and potentially this could be just because of our age demographic and flipping through Comedy Central at all hours of the day, but I'm going to do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels every single time. Doesn't matter what happens. It would have been at one time I would have totally stayed for PCU no matter what. But it's Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, hands down. I will sit through that film no matter where you take it up. And partly just because, despite the fact that the film has almost no plot line and it's just nothing but one-liners, the film is just that's a comic statue in the pantheon of just quality campy comedy films. I'm going to shut up and we're going to move along to our winners and our losers for this week. Sam, would you like to lead us off?
I can. Yeah, I'll lead us off. So hang with us here. We're going to have a pretty baseball heavy winners and losers, I think, today. So I'm going to go with the Baltimore Orioles as my winners of the week, or winners of the day at least. Yes, the Orioles suck. Yes, they have the second worst record in the major leagues. But just hear me out.
So Saturday night, they lost the Astros by a score of 23-2. Okay? So the Astros up 23-0, ran into the back of the end zone to run the clock out and gave them a pity safety, and they won by 3 touchdowns. They won 23-2 on Saturday night's game. Still, the Astros are an excellent baseball team, but it's still a Major League Baseball game. I don't think a score should ever get that ridiculous, but that's just how bad the Orioles are right now. Second worst record in the Major Leagues, whatever. So at one point, the money line opened today for their Sunday afternoon matchup at -420 in favor of the Astros, meaning someone had to bet $420 just to win $100 betting on the Astros to win today's game. That line, by the time it closed at one particular casino in Las Vegas, it closed as high as -550. It is one of the biggest spreads. It's like a top three biggest spreads in a major league game in the last 15 years. So pretty big underdogs. I'm pretty sure they led most of the game, the Orioles did, but they were down 7-5 going to the bottom of the ninth, and they won it on a two-run, two-out walk-off home run. So good on the Orioles. Big upset today. I know it's baseball and they play 162 games, so the impact of an upset is maybe not as large as it would be in a football season or a basketball season, because baseball, kind of anything can happen. But I still think that's nothing to sneeze your nose at, or nothing to sneeze at. I mean, you're one of the biggest underdogs in a major league game in the last 15 years, and you end up winning on a two-run, two-out walk-off home run at home in front of your home crowd. So good on the Orioles. That's why you play the game. Isn't that what Herm Edwards said? Did Herm Edwards say that?
That's why you play the game.
So also, loser of the week, I'm going on at least 2 weeks in a row. I'm going to have Florida in their high class, first class program as loser of the week. They had yet another player transfer out. They had a player dismissed a couple days ago. Defensive back, John Huggins. I swear, Alex, I think Florida might turn into my version of your Baylor loser of the week.
That would be fantastic.
Where I just go with them most of the time. John Huggins, defensive back. He was a special teams guy last year, but he supposedly had a breakout spring and was looking like he was going to be one of their top guys in the defensive backfield this year. Dismissed from the program. Huggins, allegedly back in October, choked a female tutor during a tutoring session. And it got to the point where the female tutor was afraid to tutor him one-on-one, I mean, for good reason. And she was okay with doing tutoring sessions in a group setting, but she refused to do tutoring sessions with him one-on-one. But hey, not to worry, Florida fans. You're a first-class program that doesn't accept transfers from rivals, especially transfers that got dismissed from that rival program for drug issues. Oh, wait. Y'all did that too. Y'all added Britton Cox from Georgia, and he got dismissed from Georgia. Not exactly a program known for its high discipline standard. Dismissed from Georgia for drug possession, and y'all added him to the roster this week. So never mind. Y'all just suck, just in general. Y'all are just the worst. So, yeah. But top-notch programs don't add transfers from rivals. They don't do it, according to one esteemed South Carolina media member.
Says some guy.
Some guy with a radio show.
Paper, rock, scissors, 40. You want to go first?
No, I can go first. I've got an NFL-heavy winners and losers. So my loser of the week, and really just of the last, 4 months, is Antonio Brown. So let's just go ahead and skip the idea of this disgusting picture of his feet that he put out on Instagram, which looked like something out of a horror movie. But what has been going on, it turns out, of a saga since at least dating back to May, is a helmet issue. Now, for those of you that don't know, Two seasons ago, the NFL implemented a new helmet issue. They updated their helmet standards to kind of meet concussion protocols, and especially with all the outcry of all the concussions going on in football, the NFL tried to be a little bit proactive in very anti-NFL style, and made a new push for a better helmet. Now, there's a lot of pushback. I'm not really sure why. I mean, obviously, I'm not playing in the NFL, so I don't know if, like, a helmet to an NFL player is much like a bat to a baseball player. Like, they just feel really comfortable in a certain helmet.
They get super particular about cleats, too.
Yeah, I think some players said it's affected their vision, maybe.
Yeah, I have heard that. But apparently there were about 31 players in the NFL that were really into this old helmet style. And Antonio Brown was one of them. So was Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, some big names. And they were given a year grace period. So last season, all of those guys continued to wear that helmet. Well, fast forward to Antonio Brown getting traded to the Oakland Raiders, and now he is trying to single-handedly fight the NFL about his helmet, saying that he should still be allowed to use his helmet. It's his risk, da-da-da-da-da. The NFL has said multiple times, no, you cannot use this helmet. The Oakland Raiders have said, no, you cannot use this helmet. Because the NFL put out a statement that said any team found to be issuing or knowingly condone the use of this helmet would face heavy sanctions. So, of course, the equipment manager for the Oakland Raiders is like, listen, dude, just use the new helmet. He showed up to OTAs the first day with the old helmet. They made him take it off. He put up a fuss, cussed out everybody on the field, but eventually used the new helmet. About a week later, he tried to sneak out of the locker room with his old helmet on again. And again, equipment managers had to chastise him, and he succumbed to the new helmet. And then he went so far as to take his old helmet and have it painted as best he could to the Oakland Raiders' new helmets. Of course, he was missing all the proper stamps and logos and all that kind of stuff. So they had to call him out on it again. He absolutely freaked out on everybody, lost his mind, stormed off. They were reporting that, like, nobody knew where he was. His teammates wasn't showing up to practice. And then 2 days ago, he had a two-hour-long conversation with the NFL league office, which they told him that he had to wear the new helmet. And he said, if I have to wear the new helmet, I'm going to retire. And this is where the saga has left off. But this is where we are. The NFL is trying to implement some very good safety standards, and Antonio Brown is such a prima donna. This is the quintessential, I'm taking my ball and going home. So for that, Antonio Brown is my loser of the week and will just forever now be known as that guy just because of an old helmet. They're really looking out for you, but apparently he doesn't see it that way.
He's just the worst.
He is literally just old hat.
Yes. And my winner of the week, I really feel kind of bad about saying this because I'm a Packers fan and my winner comes from the Bears. But last week in the Bears' first preseason game, our very own Elliott Fry passed the Cody Parker test. North end zone, 43 yards, iced by a timeout. It's good. It's not very often that you get to see a standing ovation for a preseason field goal, but it happened in Chicago. So good on you, Elliott Fry. I hope you win that spot. You passed the Cody Parker test.
Leave it to the Bears to have their own test for kickers. That is such a Chicago Bears thing because they're just terrible.
Bears have a history of breaking in Gamecock kickers, too.
That's fair. Yep.
Little dude got big leg. Hey, all right. I'm gonna go back and harp on the MLB here in just 1 second. And I had my loser being something from the golf universe, which I'm pretty sure that everybody's gonna be not surprised or impressed with. So I'm actually gonna go with two edges of a double-edged sword here. My winner of the week and my loser of the week are going to play off of one another. One, this year, just in case anybody hasn't already seen this, is the year of the home run in Major League Baseball. So there are so many ridiculous facts and figures about this year so far from the perspective of, like, take, for example, the Yankees hit a home run in 91 games in the first 7 months of the year. That's ridiculous. That's a record that, well, I mean, it eclipses the 2000 Blue Jays by one home run, but even still, having 91 home runs before August is just absurd. The Minnesota Twins are 5 home runs away from setting their single season record, and they've still got 50 games to play.
Yeah, the baseball's been juiced. And Major League Baseball won't admit to it, but the ball's juiced. Now, I mean,
that's where I'm going.
Right? Yeah. You go ahead. Sorry.
No. But I mean, speaking of the Orioles, Sam, the Orioles have allowed 223 home runs this year.
Combination of them sucking and the ball being juiced. Yep.
They have allowed 5 home run games this season.
5 home run games.
They have allowed 15 5 home run games. Jesus. The next best three are as follows: the 2016 Cincinnati Reds that allowed 9 5 home run games, the 2006 Cubs. The 2006 Cubs were the worst team in Major League Baseball in 2006. They allowed 7. 1999 Colorado Rockies allowed 7 5 home run games. Every single one of those games was in their ballpark.
Yeah, I was about to say, they play in a launch pad. So
not even fair. Yeah. Exactly. Not even a fair thing. The Orioles this year have more than doubled the Rockies record that stood for quite some time. Now,
we still have 2 months of season left.
We still have 2 months of the season. So far this season, 207 players in Major League Baseball have hit at least 10 home runs. And now I'm going to bring this back to the golf world, and I'm going to say that both the golf ball and the baseball need to get it together. It's manufacturing companies winding the baseball too tight. Pedro Martinez has already brought this to everybody and their brother's attention by saying there's no reason why this knuckle and this knuckle should be outside of this seam in the baseball. It's wound too tight, attributing to more home runs than have ever been hit in Major League Baseball. And the golf ball. Golf ball manufacturers have made something that doesn't curve. It flies 400 yards for the tour player, not for the average person. The golf ball is actually not tailor-made, not a equipment reference at all. It is not designed for the average person to be maximized to the specifications it has been made to. And it is rendering both baseball parks and golf courses obsolete at the professional level. I am not going to be old man yells at cloud here, but we have to have limits. It's cool to watch a golf ball fly 400 yards in the air. It's cool to watch people do things with a baseball or a golf ball. It's awesome to watch a ball fly over the left end at Fenway Park and ding some idiot that paid $5,000 for one afternoon in a cocktail lounge in a brownstone in Boston get like shook because a baseball landed near them. It's not normal. This is juiced up Sega Genesis version of sports, humans playing sport, and we need to figure something out. My winner and my loser of the week is sports in general.
Yay, sports.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to say sports governing bodies.
Some of those home run numbers you were throwing out, especially the one with the Orioles about the five home run games, they've given up 15 five home run games. Those are college baseball numbers when they had still had the aluminum bats back in the 90s and early 2000s. I mean, those are outrageous home run totals that you saw in college baseball when they had aluminum bats. And now you're seeing it at the pro level, but with they're using wood bats, and it. You understand what I'm trying to say? Like, that means baseball's way. I think they needed to do something to jazz the game up a little bit, because today's audience in general just is not. You know, baseball's just not. I don't think it's growing as much as it used to be, but they need to meet somewhere in the middle with where the ball was and where it is now. And maybe they'll get it fixed, but I don't know. Personally, I'm okay with it, kind of, because I think the juiced ball has really helped the Braves out, because we hit dingers a lot, and it helps us win ball games. So,
I mean, yeah, hitting dingers ain't a bad thing, but I can't figure out who it was, but there was a younger player just this week that homered in three consecutive innings, and I'm trying to figure out who it was, but
I mean, that's guy on the Cubs maybe on Saturday night.
Yeah. Three consecutive innings.
Yeah. But that pitcher, you got to put some responsibility in the pitcher, though. I mean, at some point, you got to make the guy miss.
Agreed.
You got to throw a ball, you got to throw stuff that's going to avoid the bat. I mean, you know, you can't just keep throwing stuff. I mean, yeah, he might have hit three home runs in three consecutive innings, but if he did that, that means everybody else on the team was hitting the ball all over the ballpark too, because he batted three straight innings. So what does that say about that pitcher's performance?
Well, that's true.
You know, I'm just saying. I think it's something to think about too. Anyway, we're going to talk about Gamecock football now, because that's what we're here to do. And we're
allegedly,
supposedly, we're going to talk about Gamecock football, and we're going to go into position groups again this week. But this week we're going to talk about the position group you are most confident in going into week one. Now, this is just preseason, you know, just confident in this position group. That this might change come week three, but just going into the season, what do y'all have as your most trusted position group on the football team? Richard, you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump in with this one in that, you know, this is probably going to sound crazy, especially coming from me, because I tend to always dwell on the negative, but I am incredibly positive on the quarterback position right now. Now, I know that there is some consternation about who's going to be there. Is Jake Bentley going to be the guy for the entire season? Yada, yada, yada. What are we going to do? How is this going to pan out? He has been flat in big games. Up for flat and small games, up for big games, up for small games. It's been kind of, you know, footloose and fancy free. Is he really the guy that we need? Now, I will parry that with every single time that something has come up in terms of adversity, i.e. a challenge for his position, he has played his ass off. So at least for the first week of the season, I know for a fact that Jake Bentley has his guard up, has his radar on tilt, and will be primed for week one of the South Carolina football season.
There's also some quality depth there too, and I think that's kind of the point you're making, is he's not it's not a non-challenge position anymore. I mean, he's got to play well. Otherwise, there's two guys behind him that could come in and do the job. You know,
exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly. And it almost kind of feels like he plays better with the knowledge of if he screws up, there's somebody else who's going to take his place, and he can't jump right back out there.
Well, just think about that run. Just think about that run he went on after the Missouri game last year when Skarnecchia came in. And
well, exactly.
If you go back and rewatch that game, Skarnecchia didn't play like an All-American. I mean, there were three or four balls that absolutely should have been picked off, and it was against. The worst,
Scar got lucky as heck.
It was the worst passing defense statistically, at least going into that week in the SEC. So now, not taking anything away against Skarnecchia. I mean, he did what he needed to do to help us win the ball game. But he did enough to where he showed that he was at least competent in that situation. And then Bentley was like, okay, I need to take my play to a new level. And then for like 5.5, 6 weeks or whatever, he really elevated his game, and he looked like the quarterback that everybody thought he would be after his freshman year.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I love that point. Richard's a great point. Alex, what you got, man?
Kind of on the same vein as Richard, I'm really confident right now in the wide receiver core, especially if Jake Bentley can throw the ball like we're talking about, and if he can, you know, do what we've kind of expected him to do. I know Brian Edwards seemed to struggle a little bit last year, but I think he was trying to find his place behind Debo as a number two. Mm-hmm. And with him being the guy and this being like, if he wants a shot at the NFL, this is the year he's got to do it. I think with him and Shy and a couple of those, and Ortre being as big as he is, I really feel like if Bentley is able to do the things that we know that he's capable of doing, if our running game can just stay solid, then the wide receiver core should absolutely shine. We have got some guys out there that are absolute monsters. We've also got some, you know, some real speedster guys. They say that Jay Ulrich moving to receiver, that he is a fast guy who learns very quickly.
I've read he's the fastest straight line runner on the team.
Yeah, they said that he's out running shine.
So,
which is impressive. So I feel like, again, if Jake Bentley can throw the ball like we think he's able to, I think this receiver core is going to be unbelievable this season. And I feel like that's probably the group that I'm not only most looking forward to seeing, but have a lot of confidence in.
You know, I love that you brought up Ortre Smith, because he's a guy that we haven't really seen a whole lot of because he got hurt last year.
Right.
And he's a guy that's kind of built like a tight end, but he runs like a receiver.
He's a big physical receiver that plays behind his pads, and he knocks people. He gets yards after hits.
And I'm not saying he's a better receiver than Brian Edwards, but I think he's probably physically more of a mismatch issue for other teams just because he's so big.
Right.
Like, he's ginormous. He's literally built like a tight end.
Especially depending on where we line him up. I mean, if we start putting him in the slot and having him run like little short routes, he's just going to hurt people's feelings.
Yeah, against linebackers and 5'9" mm-hmm. nickelbacks. Yeah. So I'm going to go with the defensive line. I love y'all's points about receiver and quarterback. I think those are great. But I'm going to go with the defensive line. I think we finally have a really nice mix of talented young guys to go along with the veteran studs. Talk about guys like Javon Kinlaw and DJ Wanham. Those two guys are going to be they need to play well every week on the defensive line for us to have a good team. I mean, they're the dudes on the defensive line. And you also got – and I'm leaving people out. I know that, but I can't name everybody on the defensive line. You got solid guys like Kobe Smith and Keir Thomas. I mean, guys that have been around, they know how to play. They know what Muschamp expects. And then you have a mix of young guys like Joseph Anderson, Zach Pickens, those guys that have all the natural ability. What?
Vic Pickens.
Yeah. I mean, they have all the natural talent in the world going in. So, I mean, I think we finally have the depth up front where we can – I mean, I've heard the coaches say this. They've outright said it. We haven't had the depth in the past on the defensive line where we could rotate 7, 8, 9 dudes in and out throughout the ball game. And they feel like that we're finally in a place that through recruiting we can do that. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what the defensive line has. I also read that UNC in their first scrimmage, they gave up 12 sacks to their defensive line. Okay, and pretty sure that's against a defensive line that was part of a defense last year that gave up almost 40 points per game.
My goodness.
So I don't think that speaks to how dominant their D-line is going to be. I think speaks how bad their O-line is right now.
Yeah.
So sack themselves 20.
12 times. 12 times. Still, that's a lot. So I feel like that could be a matchup problem for them. Hopefully week one. But we'll talk about that in a couple weeks a little bit more. So let's preview the second half of the season. Alex, what you got for the last six games of the year?
All right, so I've got us hosting Florida in starting off the second half of the season with a win. I know all these preseason polls have Florida like ranked so high, but I'll be curious to see if they're able to have a legitimate starting lineup when the season starts. Now, obviously, as they get to us in the second half, they'll have something, you know, worked out. But I just refuse to believe that with all the talent that they've lost, that they're going to be a top 20 team in the country. So I have us winning that game 28-17. Then I got us going up to Tennessee with a real nail biter. But I refuse to believe that Jeremy Pruitt is able to beat Will Muschamp. Doesn't matter where it's at. And I think we squeak one out at Tennessee 27-24. The next two, Vanderbilt, App State, I really feel like we're finally starting to separate ourselves. And there's nothing against a school like App State that has a good program, but I do feel like, you know, we've had a couple of close ones with Vanderbilt, but I feel like we're finally at a point in Muschamp's tenure where we're going to start to separate ourselves. I've got both of those being pretty big wins. Vanderbilt, I've got us winning 38-10, and App State, I've got us winning 40. I can't even read my own notes here. 48-14. So I do think App State will probably put up a little bit more than Vanderbilt. When we go to A&M to face the 12th man, I think that as good as we've been playing all season, being at A&M is going to be a tough one, and I think we drop that one on the road. Probably something pretty tight. A bit of a nail biter, but I do think they pull something out 17-10. And then, of course, the old Taters come to town. And, again, I just don't think we're quite at that level yet. Hopefully, if they have faltered a couple of times throughout the season, which I don't think that they will, but if they have up to that point, I think we got a good shot. But if they do what they're supposed to do, I think when they come to us with national championship and playoff implications on the line, I think it's going to be a lot closer than people think. But it'll still be we're still just a little out of reach. I think we probably lose that one 35-27.
Hey, do y'all remember when I was, like, positive DC3 last week and talked about winning football games and all sorts of stuff of that nature? I have come back down to earth again. But it's not all piss and vinegar. I think that, again, I'll reiterate that the opinions that are expressed here on the GabbaCast are not necessarily those of any rational human being on the face of the planet, nor are they the opinions of anybody affiliated with anyone in the Garnet and Black Attack Network. Florida, to start off with, so, like, my thing, yeah, absolutely. We talked about how their attrition rate has been stupendously high. I also think that there's some strange glitch in the matrix with Will Muschamp and playing Florida. I think this year may be no exception to that. And if this caveat holds true, if Florida does retain at least 22 scholarship athletes at the time of kickoff, which at the current rate might not actually be true, so then all of this is going to be null and void. But if Florida actually has 22 scholarship athletes, I feel like there's going to be some bizarre scenario by which they win something to the effect of 22-21 in overtime. that's a disgusting thing to think about. But especially when you think about it being Florida going for two in overtime. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, just desserts. At Tennessee, there is no amount of pontoon boat tailgating that can stop the fact that they suck at every skill position. And Alex already alluded to it. Jeremy Pruitt is their coach.
Okay, time out.
Yes.
You put a football at the 50-yard line, and you put Muschamp and Pruitt at the opposite 35-yard lines. They have to bum rush the football and wrestle for it for control. Who wins?
Muschamp.
No question. Muschamp.
You think Muschamp gets there first?
Yes.
Because Muschamp's kind of gotten a little thick. Man.
I think Jeremy Pruitt probably gets there first, but if it's a wrestling match for the ball, I think Muschamp just eats him alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously,
like,
but if you pick the ball up first and you have control of it, it's over. You don't need to wrestle. So
in classic Tennessee fashion, Jeremy Pruitt pulls a hammy on the 5-yard line out the gate.
Fair enough.
But also, too, you never stipulated the fact that, like, going towards the football, you didn't have to go reach the football first. Muschamp could go at Pruitt and just clock him or
DDT
him or what have you.
That's fair. That's fair enough.
I mean, and then all of a sudden, here's unconscious Jeremy Pruitt, and Muschamp just picks it up and's like, hello, hi, we have it. Possession, us.
We should just do this best 4 out of 7 instead of playing them in football.
Honest to God, I think that would be infinitely more compelling than actually playing that football game.
Like, they can still play the game, but it just won't count. It would just be for show.
I'd pay more than I would pay to watch a welterweight title fight.
I'm calling Muschamp about this tomorrow. We're going to set this up. Richard, go ahead. Sorry, I had to ask that question.
It's an excellent segue back into Vanderbilt and homecoming because
they're coached by fake tough guy Derek Mason.
What more apropos of a way to just have a hypothetical conversation about nothing than to say, let's play Vanderbilt in a football game? Much like Derek Mason's unbased like hatred for the University of South Carolina for some reason or another. It's homecoming, which makes me immediately nauseous, but also a little bit better feeling about this than if we had actually played App State at homecoming. I don't have any clue about this, but there are less than 35 points scored in the game, and I know that you guys are looking at my notes, and I'm saying L. I'm going to say Carolina wins this game 17-10.
Homecoming game for the ages.
App State. If you wanted to talk about Jeremy Pruitt and Will Muschamp racing one another to the 50-yard line for a football. If you wanted to call that a bum fight, this, ladies and gentlemen, is going to be a bum fight. It's going to be a bum fight with rocks. App State is a scrappy football team, and I hate that word in every sense of the connotations that it provides. Really? But App State is a scrappy football team, especially against a team that has got some serious issues on the O-line, and some secondary trouble. App State can exploit both of those. I think it's going to be a lot of points going on in this game. App State is not going to win this football game. App State's going to lose 35-28, but it is going to be uglier than Ruth Bader Ginsburg's backside.
That's ugly.
Buckle up. The best part about it is, it's later in the season, and you fellas can pack you a flask and tuck in. It'll also be at noon, so you can be pretty well buzzed by the time you got to go back for, you know, brunch with your mom and them. Texas A&M. This, to me, is the most important game of the season. And I think that a lot of people are going to look at me as a South Carolina trusted media member and go, you think Texas A&M is the most important football game in the season? But yeah, no, it is, bar none. It's high time that essentially the oil barons got put in their the funky militaristic oil barons got put in their place, and it's only fitting that we play both of these bozos back to back. This is the most important game of the season, no doubt about it. And I think that it is also a fortunate thing for South Carolina insofar that recency bias is going to show you this, that Spurrier-led teams tended to start the year strong, maintain it, and kind of fart out at some point in time. Will Muschamp's teams have seemed to get their stride mid-year and improve. This is the spot on the schedule where they might actually be able to do what I guess largely is the biggest gripe against Will Muschamp's career thus far. Oh, but he doesn't do very good against ranked opponents. His record against ranked opponents sucks, blah, 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 blah. He doesn't really do good in big games. Let's see what we do here. The Gamecocks finally hit their stride and capitalize on a fairly – at least in my opinion, a fairly one-dimensional Texas A&M team in a defensive battle to remember. This one has got some, this one's got some turnover problems. This one's got all sorts of stuff written all over it. 27-24. Hashtag Parker White.
Game winner?
Bingo. Clemson. I just got all happy and, you know, flowery and, you know. Clemson, hopefully the Justice Department intervenes in this whole entire situation before I need to actually think about this football game. That is all I am going to say about that because I don't want to be deposed in a PED scandal.
Yikes.
Love you, mean it.
So you're not picking that game yet?
Nope. Nope. Not rendering a verdict at all. Okay. Not at all.
All right. Also,
I want to be subpoenaed.
I'm going to note that my personal predictions, I mean, I understand that they're probably pretty unrealistic. I'm still in that super positive phase of fanment, like being a fan going into a season where you're a little less than a month away and some reality really hasn't set in like it does come week two or three. So all my predictions are based on minimal injuries happening and pretty much everything going right for the Gamecocks this year, except for one game that I'm going to pick us to lose here in a second. Florida, we win.
God, I just saw which one you picked. Good grief.
Florida, we win 30-20, and I don't think it's really that close. Florida ain't going to be that good at this rate. I think they might have to hit up the student union and put up a sign-up sheet so they can field a defense. They might have to do open tryouts with the intramural flag football teams on campus. Also, this is a revenge game. The way that game ended last year, I think we'll be fired up with it being at home. I think the Gamecocks control it the entire way. Florida gets a late score to make it look a lot closer than it was. They'll, you know, but 30-20 Gamecocks win. Y'all are going to hate me for this. But at the same time, I picked us to beat Georgia. Okay, so I have to have some sort of balance here somewhere.
It's a circle, the circle of SEC football.
Okay, so Tennessee, we're going to go to Knoxville. I don't know why. I agree. I don't think they're very good overall, but I have a really uneasy feeling about this game. Probably justified because we don't have all that great of a history in Knoxville to start with. It's going to be an ugly affair because Muschamp teams, whether it's Florida or South Carolina versus Tennessee, are almost always ugly affairs. So I think Muschamp suffers his first loss to head coach of the Volunteers. We lose 16-13 in Knoxville.
I was having a good day, too.
Sorry. We're going to come back, play Vandy on homecoming. We're going to go into this game, take control early, going to halftime thinking, oh, it's just Vandy. The game going to be way too close in the fourth quarter after the Gamecocks blow almost a 2-touchdown halftime lead. We'll pull it out 24-21. App State, really good football team. All due respect, Alex, I don't see us beating them by 38 points. They're a really good football team. I think we beat them 31-21, something like that. We'll control the second half when our depth takes over. Now, they did have a head coaching change, and maybe that'll play into effect a little bit because I think Scott Satterfield used to be their head coach. He's now at Louisville, if I'm not mistaken. He's a very good football coach. But App State's got a lot of talent for a group of – what is it, group of six? Is that the term? A mid-major football team. I think we win by 10. We go on the road against A&M. We play a heck of an offensive game. It's going to be an old, good old Texas-style shootout. But we can't get it done on the road against the Aggies. The Aggie curse lives on. We lose 35-31. Bye week, chance to recharge our batteries a little bit, play Clemson at home. I think we have a chance to win this game. We go in healthy, being at home. Most talented team Muschamp's had here. Now, obviously, everything's got to be clicking for us. But I don't think we're quite there yet. I think we lose like 34-30 at home. But I think it'll be tight the whole way. I really do. Just because I think we showed last year offensively with the right game plan, you can score at will on those guys. If we had half a defense last year, I think we have a legitimate chance of winning that game on the road. With it being at home, senior quarterback, bunch of talented skill guys, I think we have a shot. I just at this moment, I don't think we get it done. Gamecocks fall 34-32 to the Tigers. So I think that puts my overall predictions at 9-3 for the season. I think that's right. Which, given the schedule, that would be a hell of a record.
Yeah.
Overall.
No question.
I think even with a loss to Tennessee, if you finish 9-3, you're probably looking at a New Year's Six bowl game as an at-large out of the SEC. I mean, you know. So, I think we all pretty much picked our guys to win at least. Let's see. Alex.
I think I'm the most pessimistic one at 7-5.
So Alex had his 5-1 for the first six. Yeah, so Alex has us going 9-3 as well. Richard, you have us at 8-4. Yeah, it was 8-4.
Yeah, I'm 8-4.
So we're pretty optimistic bunch right now, given what our schedule looks like, but.
Oh, yes, the offseason. We haven't even had a chance to have a
date. But at the same time, you know, teams like Florida, they're not looking nearly as daunting anymore at the moment because of what they're going through with roster turnover. So, you know, again.
Well, we also haven't had any TK or any chicken yet.
Disclaimer, these predictions are subject to change at our will when we decide to because this is our podcast and you can't tell us what to do. Also, to our faithful listeners, we don't have any Twitter questions because I forgot to ask for them. So, my bad.
Well, we're podcasting. I mean, there's bad.
Yeah, but we don't have any Twitter questions. I forgot to ask for Twitter questions. So, that's where we're at right now for this week.
What do we want to talk about going forward here? So, we've got... Now, just slightly under 2 weeks till college football
and
is actually here.
Our favorite team to talk about other than the Gamecocks, the Florida Gators, they actually kick off on the 24th. So, 13 days, college football starts. Like, Division I SEC football, they play Miami on the 24th, I think, for some reason. So,
can we talk about that game for just a second, how odd that is?
Well, I'm not sure they're the only game, but I'm pretty sure they're the only, like, major game going on. Usually there's some, like, FCS games and stuff the Saturday before, but yeah, it's pretty weird. They don't usually have like an SEC versus ACC matchup the week before everybody else starts. But I'm also not complaining.
Much less at least from a historical perspective, a storied rivalry. Like, I mean, yeah. I know it's not as much as it was in years past, as years go by. But
they should play every year. Them, Miami, and Florida State should have a series every single year like the three military academies do.
They should have a round robin.
That's what I'm saying.
Trophy.
Yeah. And then Arizona plays Hawaii later that night, but nobody cares about that game because it's Arizona.
Well, back when and back when they used to do it, though, that was when Miami used to play in the old Orange Bowl.
Right, and that place was nuts when they would fill it up.
Yeah, because it was in the middle of like a war zone.
Yeah. Well, I'm just talking about the crowd noise, but yeah, also that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. The Orange Bowl was probably if you wanted to talk about a platonic ideal, the Orange Bowl from an acoustical perspective was probably the platonic ideal of a college football stadium. Uh-huh. You could have 60,000 people in there, and it felt like there were 500,000 people.
Yeah.
That's how Neyland is, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then again, you've still got 110,000 people.
Right.
There. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a loud joint.
Yeah, I remember when me and Alex went a couple years ago, they only had only 90,000 people there, and Tennessee fans were bitching and moaning about their attendance. I'm like,
and it was the loudest stadium I had been in.
I'm like, y'all still have 10,000 more than our capacity, so shut up. Yeah.
People in that part of Tennessee don't have a lot to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So when your replacement activity is, the dryer vent was clogged up with lint and my wife has been bitching about it for 6 weeks. I needed to get that done today. I know we're playing LSU, but listen, I cannot listen to Louise bitch about this one more time.
Well, granted, during the Butch Jones years, that probably sounded more appealing for somebody to do on a Saturday afternoon was to fix the washer and dryer than to go to a Tennessee football game. So
yeah, or to they're like calling their insurance representative up at the end of the day, and they're being like, "All right, now listen, now seriously, read the end of this and figure out whether or not my life insurance policy is covered if I jump off a bridge on Saturday." If I do it, what happens if I trip off the bridge? What happens if somebody pushes me off the bridge? Do we still get all that to go? When football fans are having life insurance conversations, that's probably a pretty bad fit.
So we're going to be back next week, right?
Without a damn doubt.
All right. Looking forward to it. I'll wrap
Ladies
this thing
and gentlemen,
up.
This is the South Carolina Gamecock Sports Podcast you didn't know you wanted, but you darn sure need. We are the internet's only Gamecock podcast. We are the Gabacast, live and in living color from a secure location in Greenville, South Carolina. I am DZ3, always faithfully yours. For Sam and Alex, guys, it's always a pleasure podcasting with you guys. Drive safe, go Cocks, tip your waitress.